There we go. I'm going to call the House Committee on Land Use to order. It is February the 12th, 2013, and I'm going to open public hearings on both House Bills 2284 and 2285, and ask our colleague Representative Reed to come up and tell us a little bit about these bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Committee members, I'm Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27. I might suggest, Mr. Chair, if you're all right with it, the port might join me and get settled if they're okay with that, and you are.
The whole entire port?
Yes, every bit of them.
Pretty big.
I know we have a large table.
Do
here,
you?
So,
is AP representing the port, or is Wyatt floating around somewhere? I hear his voice in the airport every time I walk through, but I don't know that he actually exists anymore. I know his voice does.
I've seen him, Mr. Chair. He's
yeah,
okay.
Please tell him, give my best.
My function really is I think, to introduce the concept and the port for the purposes of detailing the study that they conducted that really forms the basis of the concepts that are in the bill, the bills that are now before you. As part of the Transportation Economic Development Committee in the last legislature and over the interim, we had the opportunity to hear a study that the port, along with a number of other people, have completed about the state of industrial land readiness in the metro region. The short version of that, and they will go into much greater detail, is that there is not enough industrial land ready to go, and in particular, there are not enough Tier 1 sites that would be ready to go very quickly. That's a problem, and it's particularly a problem for Oregon relative to other states. When there are opportunities, we need to be able to react quickly and have sites that are ready to go when those opportunities are present. So that study is relevant and useful, but it's only for one region of the state. So there are two concepts in two bills that you have open here. One is intended to make that to take that approach, that study, to other regions in the state and understand the inventory and the opportunities around the state. The second concept is around a forgivable loan program that might help in a variety of settings the local entities to get those sites to a state of readiness so that we are equipped to respond when opportunities present themselves. Both of them are in early forms. There are similar bills with our colleagues across the building, and I think it's today is really the beginning of a conversation, but a significant step that we could and should take to further economic development in our state.
And do you need to get going? Do you want to just do questions for you before AP starts?
That would be fine.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Representative Reed? Wow. You're off easy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now let the grilling begin. Hi, Annette. What's going on?
For the record, my name is Annette Price. I'm the State Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I'll do just as a kind of a brief overview, one of the things that the port has done, and we've worked with members of this committee on brownfields redevelopment issues, is, you know, we felt it was important to take a look at least in the metropolitan region, what is the lay of the land, pun intended, of industrial lands, and how ready are they? And so with a great public and private sector coalition of folks, we embarked upon that effort and found that, guess what? There are very few properties that are ready to go. And when we're in competition with other states like Utah or Texas or states from the southeast, we're at a disadvantage. And we want to take the long view as it relates to land use and industrial land development, brownfield redevelopment, and sort of start a march forward. And it may, you know, we're hoping to get some good things done this session. We want to see things done next session and on into the future, because we have a lot of catching up to do, quite candidly. That's not a slap on anybody. It's just the state of where we are, and both the business community and the public sector, we see a need certainly from the port's perspective of wanting to move the ball forward. And whether it's the small, candidly, brownfield build site in downtown Portland or downtown Springfield. You know, we want to see some changes, or whether it's the large lot industrial property. Let's get them ready to go, because we do want to see this economy recovering. And, you know, if you guys saw the same headlines I saw this morning, we're still bumping along the bottom. And we can't be, you know, can't cost too much because of the state of our own budget. But we can take incremental steps that ultimately will make a really huge difference. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions or leave it to the certified smart folks who know the details of the study that we conducted. And so with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions in advance of the study presentation? Representative Thatcher.
I guess I would like maybe a definition of what constitutes a ready site.
A ready site is, so they're tiers. So tier one is basically 100 ready within 180 days. And Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, as you know, certainly in the valley we've had some issues with there are wetlands that aren't, you know, that cause a delay and how we treat a site. And so tier two, and I'm going to mess up the numbers. Again, we've got folks that are better with the numbers. Tier two, tier three. Tier three is multiple years out. Tier two is roughly, a 1 year, 2 years out in ready to go, meaning developable. It's one thing to say shovel ready. It's another thing to say this can be done, you know, sort of dirt being turned in 180 days, which is, you know, where we need to get to with some of these sites.
Follow-up, or Representative Holby, or what?
Go ahead. Well, I just, developable. I mean, okay, so what does that mean?
Developable means a site, it's whether it's a manufacturing plant, whether it's a, as it relates to industrial land, you know, traded sector businesses, meaning there's going to be something that goes on the property that's a buildable lot, basically.
I think what she's probably getting at is, like, are we talking, is it served by, is there infrastructure there, water pipes, sewer systems, is it zoned correctly yet, stuff like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, yes, you've got to have the infrastructure in place for it to be ready to go, and which is water, sewer, roads, et cetera.
Representative Holby.
Thanks. I'm trying to find in the bill where exactly the money for these loans for this program come from.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, to the point that Representative Reed mentioned in his opening comments, we are still working on those pieces and have, you know, looked for today to sort of bring you all up to speed on what the study did, and hope to work with you and our and your colleagues over on the Senate side to develop that further.
Thank you. You mentioned in comparison to other states like Utah and Texas, we pale in comparison to their site availability. Can you give us a little bit of a sense of kind of what, how we really do compare our site to site or state to state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Unger, as an example, you know, we have a tendency here in Oregon, we can show a company one site, and other states can show multiple sites, and it puts us at a disadvantage from a recruiting standpoint, and we're hoping to change that. We're not going to get to, for example, you know, having dozens of sites. It's just not, you know, necessarily what's available here in Oregon, but we want to do a better job of improving our chances, if you will, because, as you know, I mean, we have companies that want to locate here because it is Oregon, and yet when we don't have a larger choice, and a larger choice may be, you know, a handful of sites, that's what puts us at a disadvantage.
Vice Chair Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and apologize for being tardy. Question about being ready, though, and only showing them one site. I guess the question I would be is, even if they picked that site, has there been any kind of measurement of how long it takes to get through the process from, okay, we're going here in Oregon to get build and operating versus the other two states you just referenced? Is there any research that's been done on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, that's what the folks yet to come will talk a little bit more about, and that goes to the tiering that we have and the lack of sort of that tier one sort of development ready site. But the folks that are yet to speak will address that issue.
And Annette, you or somebody else could talk about this, but maybe it would be helpful, unless it's already part of the presentation, to review what last session's Senate Bill 766 allows for, so people sort of know what we just did recently. And I think we have one maybe now in Goshen, however you say that, that's, you know, eligible for something like this.
Chair Clem, I think the folks that are coming up behind me can do a more thorough job of that.
Okay. Anything else for AP, or get on to the presentation of the study and such? Okay, don't go too far. We may need you again.
I'll be in the back.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
So please, whoever I've got on my list, OBA, Business Oregon, and City of Portland.
Yeah,
that's
the names.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, why don't you introduce yourselves, because I have no idea how... Who's who? Yeah. Welcome.
Hi.
Whoever you are.
Okay. Mr. Chair, representative of the committee, my name is, for the record, is Mike Williams. I'm the industrial land specialist for Business Oregon.
And my name is Mark Clemens. I am the economic development director for the city of Hillsborough. I was also the project manager for this project that we're going to talk about today when I was at Group McKenzie Architects, Engineers, and Planners.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bernie Bottomley with the Portland Business Alliance. We're one of the partners on the study.
Okay. Please begin.
Okay. Over the next few minutes, we're going to be telling you a little bit about a study that Business Oregon's participation was primarily due to its interest in site readiness. Business Oregon has a program, site certification. It's been a real successful one where we've gotten quite a few 73 sites across the states ready for development within 180 days. We probably have one of the best programs in the country. And this is really an application of this program across many sites across a region. And we thought that would be a great application because it would really be able to tell us and help us do a number of things. It would help us market the sites better, especially the sites that were found to be ready to go in 180 days. It would also help us prioritize maybe which sites that we should spend a little bit more time on with our site certification program and try to get up to that 180-day site selection posture. So why do we think that it's so important to have these types of sites? These sites, we have regular demand for these types of sites from traded sector companies, mostly from manufacturing companies, but also from important warehouse distribution, logistics company that are very important for supporting our overall infrastructure, including the port. The site selectors that we talk to on a regular basis that are looking at these sites, they need these sites. They need certainty on these sites. They don't want to find out that there's problems on these sites that are going to take. They don't want to commit to a site and then find out that there's a wetlands problem that's going to that they can solve, but it's going to take a year to solve. They don't want to find out that there's brownfield issues there that they didn't know that were there. So they're looking for certainty as well as speed to market. And what you're going to see is a study that looked at a lot of sites at once in order to do this. There has been consistent demand for these types of sites in Oregon, Business Oregon. We track these opportunities. We do see on an ongoing basis demand for 50 and 100 acre sites. And I'd also like to stress that these sites are also good candidates for industrial business parks, for parks with multiple tenants, multiple users. In Oregon, a lot of times we get bogged down into one user for one site, one business for one site. But I think if we're going to use land efficiently, sometimes we need to think in terms also in terms of business parks. So Business Oregon, we see a lot of these opportunities. There's also been a number of private surveys that have shown that there's a regular need for these types of large sites. What you're seeing here is our across many of our traded sector industries. These are the industries that Business Oregon is involved in on a regular basis. We have some thresholds that we tell communities, if you want to be in the running for the majority of leads that come through our door for these particular types of users, you need to have a site of this size. We're not saying that every user that comes in needs every regional nationally skilled clean tech firm needs 50 acres, every heavy industrial manufacturer needs 25 acres, but if you want to be attractive to the 80%, 90% of the opportunities that we see that come through Business Oregon, you need to have a site of this size, and you need to have a site that's ready to go in 180 days. Here you see, again, it's kind of a breakdown. This is a period of just Business Oregon leads that came through us, not the leads that came through the private sector, that came through Business Oregon broken down by acreage. And as you can see, we get a number of leads across all different site size categories. But if you look at the above 25 acre, that's close to 16% of the sites are above that acreage, and that has been the area where we've had the most problems with readiness. One is because we have less sites that are large; we have a limited supply of those sites, and two, sometimes big sites have big problems, like especially things like wetlands. Again, looking across industries, this is just another cross-section of looking at the number of opportunities we've seen in each of these industry categories, the largest amount of acreage that we've seen in each category. So you can see in a number of these, in two of the categories, we needed sites over 200 acres. I don't believe we have a ready-to-go site in the metro area that's over 200 acres. We've got another site that another largest acreage requirement for 160. Again, that would be another difficult one to serve.
That's me.
Yeah.
Really? Okay. Didn't know I was starting here.
Well, you are, so keep going.
I am, so we will. So the project in Portland, as I said, I was the project manager for the project as a consultant. This was the 200-acre, the large site issue, and there's a lot of discussion about the large site portion of it. This was driven a lot from Metro's UGB analysis, and when Metro did their analysis for industrial land as part of their UGB study process, they determined a lack of large sites. When they defined large sites as greater than 50 acres or more, that there was not a adequate supply of those in the metropolitan area. We went down to 25 acres in our study group because we felt that 25 acres got a bigger part of the market. You saw the numbers up there, and there's also demands in that smaller acreage in the 20 acres and even 10 acres. But so we started at 25 acres. And there had been a lot of work done, and when Metro does their analysis, it's often on, or is exclusively really on, gross acreage. So they just do an analysis and says, okay, we've got X number of acres needed to meet our expected job growth. And there isn't an analysis of the readiness of that acreage. And that's where we were looking to get a better understanding of the readiness of this, because for when a company shows up, it needs to be ready. It just doesn't need to be a gross acreage of 100 acres. They need to have net acres of 100 acres to be able to develop oftentimes, or they need a net number, not a gross number. So we wanted to provide better data, and we also then wanted to take that opportunity when we provided better data to give that to policymakers such as yourself to start to lay the foundation for discussions such as we're having here about what to do about the issue. We started off with I won't go into the lengthy amount of detail, but we basically started at a very high level of data in the region, looking at gross acreages of land in the metropolitan area. We went then through an analysis, and the funnel basically shows the analysis that we went through, where we looked at all of the issues associated with floodplain, slope, sort of the natural features that would start to diminish the net acreage availability on a site. We also looked at parcel aggregation, which is a big issue, because we oftentimes don't have larger parcels that are in single ownership. They're often in multiple ownerships, and that's a challenge also. We then funneled down where we were throwing sites out. We actually started out with I think 18,000 parcels in this database, and kept going down. We then looked at this issue of market readiness, and this gets into where we overlaid not just the natural features, but this time to market issue. This is this 180 days. This is when you have a company that's looking for a site, that company is oftentimes on a very, very fast timeline. Product cycles go very quickly. Companies now are looking much more quickly and at siting and getting started. They don't have 2 or 3 years to work on getting a site ready. When they're out there in the market, they're looking to getting started with a product to market, generally within 12 to 24 months, and we've got to be able to have a site that's ready to go. So we looked at transportation, we looked at all the infrastructure availability, we scored that on all of these sites across the region, and then we put them into these tiers, and this is the tiering system. So tier one sites were sites that were, and this is consistent, as it says, with the State of Oregon Site Certification Program. Tier one sites are those that would be shovel-ready within 1 to 6 months. Tier two sites are shovel-ready within 2 to 2 months. 7 months to 30 months, 2.5 years, and then tier three is greater than 30 months. So the findings of the phase one of the work, we ended up with 56 total industrial sites greater than 25 net developable acres in the metropolitan area of Portland. Those sites, again, often would mean multiple owners to make a site. 9 tier 1 sites, 16 tier 2 sites, 31 tier 3 sites. So you can see this isn't probably unexpected. This is the sort of numbers that you're looking at. On the tier 1 sites, though, there were actually only 5 that we determined actually what we would term had broad market appeal, and 2 were for lease only of the 9. 1 was priced at really a commercial price. It was on the market, but it was being priced at a not an industrial rate, but a commercial property rate. So it has just been sitting there not moving based on the property owner's desire for a return. So there was 5 sites that had broad market appeal. Since this has actually been done, there's actually been a couple more that have fallen off. This was completed as of October of last year. This is a distribution by acreage. Gives you the breakdown. You can see the majority of the sites are in the smaller category, 25 to 49, and then you see fewer, only 5 sites, 50 to 99, and then 5 sites greater than 100. Only 1 site that's tier 1 in the metropolitan area that is greater than 100 acres. Those 6, which are longer term, 3 years, it's really 3 years plus. One of those sites is located along the Lambert River Superfund site. A couple of those are actually in urban reserves, so they're not in the UGB yet. And a couple of them are actually operating gravel operations that would need to be brought online over the next 10 years or so, because they're going to need to be refilled for gravel. But they're zoned industrial and they're in the UGB. Constraints. So what did we find about, what are the issues that are associated with the Tier 2 and Tier 3 sites? This is just a breakdown. There was some sites had multiple issues associated with them, so they don't add up to the numbers of sites. But you can see brownfield cleanup being an issue on 8 of the sites. Natural resource issues, that's floodplain and wetland issues. Lack of infrastructure, lack of transportation, land assembly. Here's the kicker, too. There's 14 of these sites actually had land assembly issues. You had more than one property owner, and you needed to assemble the site. State local actions, those are things like moving the UGB, developing a concept plan. They aren't ready to go from a planning or comp plan perspective. And then because this was market, we wanted this to be market oriented, I hope you've picked that up now, is that actually 18 of the sites were actually, the owners were not willing to transact. So they're in the inventory, but again, they're not in on the market right now. The other thing we did was we also looked broadly at sites that, we looked at all sites, and so we actually looked at sites that were owned by a user and that they were for expansion purposes. Okay. So there was sites that were owned by Providence and Legacy, Genentech, Intel. Those get added into the metro gross acreage of industrial land, but those sites are all owned by someone who has future plans for them, so they're not really on the market. They may be on the market sometime in the future, and we wanted to document them, and they are documented in the study. They're there, but they're not part of that 56 number.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking for glazed eyes. Wondering if you want to take questions on this portion. We're going to transition to another segment of the analysis. If you want to do that now, if you want to just move on.
Burning questions right this moment? I think you're okay.
Okay, great. So Mike talked about the genesis of this being, you know, looking at the businesses that Business Oregon is trying to recruit to the state of Oregon, and that sort of drove the initial analysis. Mark just gave you an overview of the inventory that we did, and we identified a shortage or a very constrained number of large sites and even smaller sites that are currently ready to go. The third phase of this project, or the third phase of this presentation, is to tell you about 12 of the sites that are in the pipeline that are not currently ready to go that we did an in-depth analysis of to determine what it would take to get them from where they are now, 2, 3, 10 years out, to the point where they are ready for an end user to break ground on them. So this is a map of the 12 sites that we looked at around the region. We picked the sites not necessarily because they're easy or low-hanging fruit. We picked them to be representative of the kinds of challenges that the sites face. So we picked sites that have wetlands, that have brownfields. We picked sites that have aggregation issues, slope issues, water, sewer, and then we also picked sites that represented different types of potential end users. So manufacturers, globally scaled high-tech, clean tech, and warehouse. This is really the punchline of the whole presentation. So if you remember nothing else, remember this slide. This is an evergreen site, so one of the 12 that we analyzed. And what we did when we looked at these sites was, working with the local jurisdiction, we determined what kind of end users might be appropriate for that site. And this particular site is out in Hillsboro. It's near Intel, and it's appropriate for a globally scaled clean tech type of facility. That analysis allowed us to gauge what kind of infrastructure it would need. So how much water, how much sewer, how much power, what kind of traffic impacts it would generate. It also allowed us to scale and analyze how many employees would be on that site and what kind of wages they would be earning and what kind of property tax that site would generate. So in this slide, you see on the black line at the bottom, is what the local jurisdiction can expect to generate on this site in the way of a property tax. And for purposes of this analysis, we assumed either an enterprise zone or an SIP type of... For this one, it's an enterprise zone. So you can see the property tax is flat for the first few years. Even if you didn't have the enterprise zone in there, you can see that the slope of the two lines is that the local property tax is not going to be as high as the other line. The other line is the state income tax that's derived from the payroll that's being generated on that site. And as you can see, the state does very well, very quickly, if that site is being used for the model purpose that we had here, which was a clean tech manufacturing. About 80% of the tax value generated by this site comes to the state.
Let me just add that the analysis on the property tax side looked only at land and buildings. It didn't look at equipment. So this is underestimating for this because it doesn't include the equipment. And in a clean tech or a high tech manufacturer, the equipment is where the value is. But because of the difficulty of depreciation schedules and SIP agreements and things like that, we really couldn't analyze that. So this is slightly underestimating the property tax return because of the methodology of the study, and it's a particularly appropriate with this type of user. So I just want to make
sure. I do have a question. I think maybe before we go on,
yeah,
I might forget. But it sounds like you're in kind of predicting maybe this site would be appropriate for clean tech. What if somebody else is interested in it? Is it then, I mean, like, I don't know, just somebody else that's not in clean tech is interested? Are you just anticipating for the sake of planning and trying to figure out how to market it, or what? It's not for, you know, limiting perspective?
No, absolutely not. Okay. No, what we did for this analysis, it's not intended to limit what the site would be used for.
Okay.
We looked at the highest, what we gauge to be the highest and best use for that site based on the market factors that exist in that market, and working with the local jurisdictions and with the real estate brokers and developers in the region. So
the next one will have a general manufacturing.
Yeah, so I'll show you another example. This happens to be a very, you know, extreme example because of the clean tech, high wages that clean tech pays on their sites. Go ahead. So just very quickly, 116 acres. The market gap, so the amount of money that has to come in to get this site ready is $13 million, a little over $13 million. But once it develops, if our modeling is correct, if our assumptions are correct, 1,700 direct jobs and a payroll of $232 million. Significant payroll and job creation there. These are traded sector jobs, so you get a multiplier effect of 2 or 2.5 additional jobs for every direct job there, which gives you the 12,000 direct and indirect jobs. Over 20 years, the state revenue on this site, on the tax on the payroll, is $153 million, and the local cumulative revenue on the property tax is $35 million. Total of $2.8 billion in total economic activity over that 20-year period if this site develops as a clean tech facility like we've modeled. Okay. So here's another example. This one is
one
not...
One moment, Bernie.
Sure.
Yes, yeah. Chair Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bernie, can you go back to the market gap of $13.4 million and talk about how that is computed?
Sure.
There's two numbers there. Yeah. I added the number.
Yeah, there's two different issues that you're looking at there. One is the cost of the infrastructure. So it gets rather complicated, but what we looked at was the land value, essentially, and what would the land value have to inflate to in order for the site to self-fulfill, for the property to be valuable enough that the owner would go in and fix the brownfields, fix the wetlands, you know, those kinds of things. It's a combination of that and the time value of money, so the risk that somebody would have to take in order to do that investment now, not knowing how long it's going to take for that site to eventually get built out. And that goes to the question that you raised earlier about how long is the permitting process and so forth. So for each of these sites, we analyzed what the permitting process would look like.
So the $13 million is the hard costs for transportation, off-site infrastructure, on-site, wetlands mitigation, et cetera, and it's about 3 years to do that work on the $13 million. The $13.4 million is this market gap, and that compares, as Bernie said, the all-in costs associated with this site, which is infrastructure acquisition. We factored in an acquisition number. The time cost of money and the risk associated with this site being developed by a developer. And so that number, the all-in costs, and this, again, this does get complicated, but the all-in costs are $42 million for everything. So hard, so the $13 million plus adding all those others gets you to $42 million, and the development ready value is $29 million. So the difference between those two is the market gap, and that's the $13 million. So it is complicated. There's two different numbers there.
That's great. I appreciate that. And I want to follow up to my earlier question then. You have that comparison to this similar property to the states of Utah and the Texas.
We didn't, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, we didn't have the resources to analyze in this level of detail, you know, sites outside of Oregon. So we can give you sort of the timeline here with the existing, you know, rules that you have to go through on sites here, but we don't have a good, you know, solid comparison for other sites.
Follow up for me.
Yep.
So if I'm a business person from somewhere in the United States, I'm going to have those numbers. I mean, before I make a decision whether I come to Oregon or Texas or Utah, I'm going to have that number.
Certainly one of
them. So why wouldn't we have that number?
Well, it was sort of beyond the scope of what we could do with the resources that we had with this study. We did try to look at, you know, examples in other states, what the inventory is in other states. And so much of that is based on marketing. So they want, you know, they want to put their best foot forward and say, oh, yeah, we've got lots of space and it's really cheap and all the resources are there to do. And so it was, the data just wasn't very good.
We didn't feel to pretend to be a buyer, go there, kind of see what the real, you know.
Yeah. My point is we are in a competitive environment.
Absolutely.
And we need to know what our competitors are doing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Unger.
And then is the proposal that's before us here to basically loan out the funds to close this market gap and get this site industry ready? Is that more or less what you're proposing that we would do?
Yeah, oversimple, but yes. A little more nuanced than that, but yes.
And then right now, who would, if someone came and wanted to, sorry, can I ask Bella? If someone wanted to come and build 116 acres out in East Evergreen, like, or when Genentech moved in, for example, which is right next door to the site, who paid?
It's usually a combination of the local jurisdiction tends to do a lot of the work. So if you look at Ron LaRaker's in Hillsborough, the city did all of the work to acquire and aggregate all that land out there through an urban renewal district. It can be that. It can be, so in the case of some of the port facilities, the port puts their money into it. And then SDCs and the end user, if you have an end user in hand. What this concept is trying to do is move back in time a little bit from the point where you have an end user and put us in a position where we're more attractive when you're looking at expansion of existing facilities or trying to recruit a new business, so that we're not in the position of sort of not having enough to show them.
Sure.
To get that end user in the first place. You see what I'm saying?
Okay. One last follow-up. So what you're saying is right now, more or less, some government entity is picking up the tab for a lot of these things, and what you're trying to do is centralize that tab picking up?
It's typically the local jurisdiction in or in combination with a private developer. But most of the the vast majority of the responsibility now lies with the local, what we call the local sponsor, a port district, a county, or a local economic development district. But as you can see from the two graphs, they're not the ones that make that the most return on the investment that they're making. So to get back to Representative Thatcher's question, this is we modeled another site which was not appropriate for a globally scaled clean tech. This is a general manufacturing site. You can see that the property tax and income tax benefits are a little closer here, but even in this case, where you don't have the kind of wages that are coming off the site, you still get more benefit on the state income tax than you do on the property tax. So this is a smaller site, a smaller gap. $4.5 million is the hard costs. As Mark mentioned, $4 million is the gap that needs to be bridged for this site to be development ready. 630 jobs, $28.5 million annual payroll.
Representative Unger.
Do we have these generic examples are really nice, but surely we have specific examples of sites that have been recently developed that give us real numbers. Do you guys have any of those?
Yeah, we can get those to you. We've got example sites that have developed, and of course these are longer term numbers. These are over 20 years, so you have to. You'd have to correct for inflation and all those other things. But, yeah, we can get you those.
That'd be great. Thank you.
So just to recap the two phases of the study, we don't have a lot of sites, particularly the larger sites inside the UGB. My wife and I just bought a house in Portland. And if a realtor had said to us, I can show you one house, we probably wouldn't have gone with that realtor. And that's kind of the situation that we face in, at least in the Portland metro region and a lot of other places around the state. We just don't have a lot of selection to choose from and are not attractive to recruitments and also expansion. And the case studies show that there's significant benefit if we are able to turn these sites over. A lot of the market gap and the infrastructure that's needed for these sites are off-site capital infrastructure, roads, water and sewer. Transportation is the most ubiquitous challenge that these sites face. Every site that you look at has a transportation issue, and it's also very expensive to address transportation. There are very few tools for local jurisdictions to use in offsetting those transportation costs. Site aggregation is a considerable challenge on particularly the bigger sites. We don't have the tools that we used to have on site aggregation in terms of condemnation for private use. So we have to find more creative ways to address that. It's also a very long-term issue. It takes a long time to negotiate multiple ownership into a consolidated deal. The infrastructure takes, two and a half years to build, even once you've got the funding and the permitting in place. And then the final issue is that a lot of these sites we don't have a lot of information about. They have wetlands on them, they have brownfields, they have other constraints. And there's a gap, a knowledge gap between the current owner and the potential developer. The current owner believes that the site is worth, 10 times what the market will actually provide. And they have no incentive to pay for an analysis that will inevitably result in information that shows that it's not worth 10 times what the market will bear. The potential end users who have not gotten a commitment from the current owner to sell to them have no incentive to spend the money to do that analysis in order to get that information either, because they might do the analysis and the owner might say thank you very much and go to some other buyer. So being able to close that gap reduces the risk and the cost associated with that risk for these types of sites.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Thatcher.
Going back to the transportation issues, I think you said it was one of the largest constraints. Certainly other states have to get roads and make the infrastructure available. Have we seen what other states do when it comes to the transportation issue, where maybe there's a difference between what our state does versus another state that would make it a little easier if we changed our transportation policy? Or are we, you know, have we looked at that? The subcategories, I guess, of constraints under the different big categories?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, it was a great question. I don't think we're alone in this challenge. There are a lot of states that have transportation challenges, particularly around these kinds of developments where, you know, you have not a freeway or, you know, a federal facility, but a county interchange, a three-lane county interchange that needs to be reworked if this development happens a couple of thousand yards or a quarter of a mile away, because the traffic impact is going to overwhelm that intersection. So you need left turn lanes, you need new signalization, those kinds of things. You know, different states have approached it different ways. A lot of states use a sales tax. Sky didn't fall, but, you know, a lot of states use that as the mechanism to fund these kinds of things. And right or wrong, a lot of times you'll see retail development paying for this kind of infrastructure by a sales tax on the new development. And so that's one of the ways that they deal with it. We just don't have that, obviously don't have that mechanism here.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. We've got at least 70 years of practice in the United States and now in economic development, incentivizing practices. And I think you've presented very well that we do have a problem in the Portland metro area with industrial site readiness. I think you've done a great job at that. But to this specific proposal, or the two specific proposals we're considering today, and maybe you'll get to this, and if you do, please emphasize it, what's the data showing that these two programs are the way to bridge the gap in the best way? And then to dovetail, the second part of my question is to dovetail off Vice Chair Cameron's question, which is, we may not have good comparison data state to state on the sites, but surely we would have good data on the economic incentive programs state to state that are being offered. You just addressed one of them,
sure.
Sales tax supported,
right.
But other states have different ways they skin this goose, so how do they do it?
So, Mr. Chair,
and if you'll get to it in your presentation,
Representative Davis, I'm just about there.
Fine. Yeah.
So thank you. So this was the overall conclusion of the report. Basically, these sites that are challenged are not going to develop on their own in the short term. It's going to take a long time for the value of the site to naturally inflate to the point where the owner can afford to make the investment to bridge that market gap. And that just simply means that those jobs are not being created in the short term. If you aggregate together these 12 sites, and assuming that they were all to develop over the 20-year period, we generate 12,000 jobs, average wage almost $100,000 a year. And then you can see the rest of the benefits there, significant state income tax benefit from the job creation and significant economic activity. So coming to the two pieces of legislation before you.
Sorry, one quick question. Sure. And those numbers all are within UGBs and reserves areas, avoiding any debates about, you know, whatever, minusing out the farm.
Chair Clem, that's exactly right. One of the sites is in an urban reserve, but the rest of them are all inside the UGB. So that was the issue that we were looking at. So the two bills. 2285 is a rather straightforward idea that we would like other communities around the state to have the opportunity to do this kind of analysis in their area. We happen to be fortunate that we had the Port of Portland, Metro, NAOP, our organization, and Business Oregon, who all had resources that we could pool to do the two phases of this analysis, to do the inventory and then to do the due diligence on the sites. 2285, the intent there is to provide funding for other communities to do first an inventory, so see what they have and what they lack, and then to, not the way that we did it where we did 12 sites, but pick a couple of sites that are the most likely to be the ones that are next in line to be developed, and to do due diligence on those sites so that they know what the challenges are for those sites, and they can price the infrastructure that would need to go in there and have a sense of what the business model is for that site. Any questions on that particular piece?
Good.
Okay. So 2284 gets to the question of where does the money come from, which was Representative Holvey's question and Representative Davis as well. The concept here is a little bit like tax increment finance. If you look at that the income that comes to the state over time from these sites on the tax on the payroll, you can see that there's significant benefit to the state. From the study, you know that these sites are not going to develop in the short term unless we find a way to bridge that gap. So that money is there to be had, but you don't currently get it. If you make an investment up front in developing these sites and we get successful in landing the end user, the state gets the revenue. So the concept here is basically the local jurisdictions are the ones that do all of 99%. Business Oregon does a terrific job, but 99% of the effort on most of these sites is done by the local jurisdiction, the port, or their economic development entity. They take the risk. They dedicate the staff to working year after year to try to bring these sites to fruition. But when they do turn over, it's the state that's the big winner. So we're looking for a mechanism that allows the state to participate without any risk or with very, very little risk in the work that that local jurisdiction is doing. And the concept here is a partially forgivable loan. The state would loan funds to the local jurisdiction under an agreement that would be negotiated with Business Oregon. After going through your inventory and your due diligence, you would have information about sites, about what the site needs, what kind of infrastructure it needs, what the cost of that would be, and what the potential revenue generation and job creation on that site would be. That would give you the information that you as a local sponsor and Business Oregon need to decide whether that's a good risk or not. Business Oregon, if they agree with that assessment, would have the opportunity to loan money for the infrastructure development. Local jurisdiction would do that development, land an end user, the state would begin generating revenue, and would use that a portion of that revenue stream to pay off half, up to half of the loan. The reason that it's low or no risk is that the way that this is structured, the state is not on the hook if the site doesn't develop. The local sponsor, is a port district or city or county, holds that loan. It's their responsibility, and the state has no obligation to forgive any of that loan unless the site develops and it actually is generating the revenue that allows the state to offset its expense. In the legislation, we are suggesting a couple of firewalls or points of reassurance for the state in terms of not overextending itself. So the first is, unless the site is actually generating revenue, the state doesn't have any obligation. The second is that only half of the revenue that the site generates would be used to offset the loan. So the state is actually getting more revenue even as it's helping reimburse the cost of the infrastructure. And the third is, for budgeting purposes, so that you know, the legislature knows how much it's obligated to over time, the total amount of obligation can be capped in any particular biennium. So you know you can, for budgeting purposes, you're not going to spend more than X. So to Representative Davis's question, are there other states that are doing this? We modeled this idea on legislation that's been enacted in Pennsylvania primarily and a couple of other states. Theirs is uses exactly the same mechanism, but it's on the sales tax, and they have it. It's not something we would want to emulate here, but basically they build shopping centers on freeway interchanges, and they use the increment generated by the shopping center to pay for the infrastructure for the interchange. So we're taking that good idea poorly applied and moving it to an industrial setting where we think we get tremendous benefit because we're creating jobs that are traded sector and very highly compensated.
Mm-hmm. Representative Holvey. Yeah.
So along those lines, I'm curious about the, you know, because several of the slides showed, you know, the income stream out 20 years. So are you thinking that the estimated incremental income tax revenue is that revenue over 20 years is what is going to establish the potential for the loan amount?
Well, it would be a combination of the due diligence. So Business Oregon would be analyzing the potential, the offered cost. So a local sponsor would come and say, I need a $20 million road. And Business Oregon would look at it and say, well, your site is only going to generate, you know, $5 million of revenue over 20 years. So obviously that doesn't match up. So the biggest regulator of that is going to be the amount of revenue that the site is going to generate. That will inform and control the amount of expense on the.
Well, and that's what I was getting at, follow-up, Mr. Chair, was on the one slide you showed $153 million over 20 years. So does that establish your potential for making a loan on that project if their site readiness preparation that qualifies for the loan that has a list that should be a little bit narrower in my mind, but you know, that would then establish what you could loan on the property.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, yes, that would be the maximum limit, and if you took all those sites, it would be $120 million, and obviously you wouldn't do all 12 sites because some of these are not low-hanging fruit. You know, in all likelihood, Business Oregon and the local sponsor is going to be very cautious because they're still on the hook for, you know, the investment. They're going to be very cautious and diligent about picking the site that is the very, you know, best opportunity that they have.
Vice Chair Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one, you mentioned Pennsylvania and a sales tax and a shopping center, and you said not well applied. Or can you tell us about what they're doing and your comment there?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I just mean that they have a different land use model, obviously, than we do. They build shopping centers on interchanges, you know, kind of leapfrogging out into the countryside, and I don't think that's the model that we have here. So it's a good fiscal model. It's a good model to help generate infrastructure. It's not just the way it's applied there is not the way that we would want to apply it here.
But it's a but it's a sales tax,
right.
And they take the sales tax that's generated by the shopping center
exactly,
and use that to pay for the infrastructure.
Exactly. So in our model, it's the income tax on the wages that are paid on this site that has been developed. That's our version of the sales tax here.
One's more retail-driven, one's more manufacturing.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I got a lot of questions swimming around, but what Representative Holvey was saying, that you would take your projection over, I guess, the 20 years, about how much income tax revenue would be generated from the payroll, and that would be sort of the basis for the loan. And so one of my questions is, in constructing this number, what were, like, business cycles figured in as far as, you know, often the economy kind of goes down cyclically? Okay, so that's in there. So it's not all, you know, a straight line up.
Right.
Okay. And then my other question had to do with, well, first of all, Pennsylvania has a lot more freeways than we do, but neither here nor there. That's what you mean by generation of revenue is just simply the income tax. And so when a company like Solyndra, I mean, just throwing that out there, they didn't last too long, but I'm sure they, I'm sure they paid people for a while. So what would happen in that situation where a company that comes in, you know, things look all rosy and great, and then there is some income tax generation going on?
Sure.
And then they fall on their face. What happens?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, just to reassure you, the state would not be at risk there.
Just the local government would be held.
The local government would still, you know, and that's a risk that they take now. You know, Hillsborough didn't know when they did Rondler Acres that Intel was going to land there. So there was a risk that they would never get their money back. So this doesn't change that fundamental equation. I think in the case that you're talking about, the hope would be, the expectation would be that infrastructure is still in place, and even if the first user of that site didn't end up surviving, that there would be a subsequent user of that site.
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Chair?
Yeah, follow up.
So is that by, that puts the local government on the hook, is that by contract, or, because it sounds like to me when I'm reading this, that the state is making the loan based on income tax that would be coming to the state in the next 20 years, and not the local government. So how does the local government become on the hook for that?
So the Mr. Chair, Representative Hovey, there is one layer of risk in this, and that is that the local jurisdiction defaults on that loan.
That wouldn't happen in Oregon.
We're not talking about huge amounts of money here, so I don't think it's going to be, you know, it's not going to rock the budget. The state is not obligated to forgive that loan unless they get the revenue that's generated by that site. So the local jurisdiction is still on the hook for it. There is, you know, some level of risk that the local jurisdiction would default on the loan, but I think a very low level of risk.
Can I take a shot at that, too? Having moved from the consultant to the local government part of this now, we would be the ones on the hook, so to speak. And I think one of the things that this model did, and we did not get into this, but we actually have the ability on each of these investments. So we look at transportation. All of the investments have a time attached to them. So this, if you make this investment, you reduce the time to market by 6 months. If you make this investment, you reduce the time to market by a year. So what I think is more likely to happen is that the local jurisdiction would look at a site and say, where can we make an investment that gets us the quickest return or shortens the time to market? And that the local jurisdiction would probably pick one or two of the infrastructure or the constraints to address. They might not take all of the constraints and try and finance all of the remediation of those constraints. You might just say, we'll take the loan on and we'll use it for a transportation improvement, or we'll use it for water and sewer, for example. And so I think it's going to be appropriately scaled at the local jurisdiction to reduce their risk. And I would agree also that what we're doing is we're actually investing in an asset that carries on into the future, so that if a subsequent company comes on board, I mean, that would have to be worked out. I haven't thought of that yet in terms of how it would actually transfer to subsequent. But if the loan is taken out by the jurisdiction, and the jurisdiction is on the hook, and the state is saying, you know, that over time as that loan is due, and over time as payroll taxes are generated, that it doesn't matter if it's the first company in or the second company in, that we're still able to capture those payroll taxes to go towards the loan, because you have an asset. You're not just giving it to the company. You're putting it into the land itself. So those are, I think, details as we think through more about this that can be, you know, and I think it's more reasonable to think this is going to be a smaller scale than rather dealing with the $33 million shortfall on a particular site. It's unreasonable that a local jurisdiction is going to look at taking that kind of risk on a loan.
Chair?
Representative Davis.
Thank you for your testimony again. So looking at the terms of the bill, project sponsor, quote, means a public or private owner of a state or regionally significant industrial site. And if the program is approved upon qualification of a project sponsor, which may be a private entity or a public entity, the department, the state, may enter into a loan agreement. So just to clarify what's available under this program, it could be a loan directly to a city or a county to directly develop a site, or a loan directly to a private entity to develop a site. And in that case, in the second case, in terms of risk, is the local jurisdiction a surety on that obligation?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think what we wanted to do, since we couldn't anticipate every potential combination.
Sure.
And a lot of these projects are public-private partnerships of one sort or another. We really left that, those kinds of details, to the negotiation between Business Oregon and the local sponsor to work out. We didn't make an assumption that the local sponsor would have to be, the public sector sponsor would have to be the one to hold the risk.
Okay. Follow up?
Yep, follow up.
And the second piece would be about the loan forgiveness. Could you talk about, I don't think that's really been addressed in the testimony so far, but could you talk about conditions under which that would occur?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, the conditions would be that you fulfill the contract with Business Oregon, mm-hmm. and that contract would consist of a number of parts. It would be what you as the local sponsor promised to do. So what kind of infrastructure did you say you were going to build? Did you build it? Did you build it at the price that you told us that you were going to build it at? And did the site perform in the way that you anticipated that it was going to perform in terms of producing jobs and revenue?
Okay. So that would all be part of the pre-development agreement.
Exactly.
Say 500 jobs in 5 years, forgiveness only after that fifth year of demonstrating this amount of income tax revenue, this many jobs, this amount of private investment in the infrastructure of the site.
Right.
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
Representative Holby.
So, following up on that question, so the loan forgiveness amount would never be more, and correct me if this is an incorrect statement, so the loan forgiveness amount would never be more than the assets of infrastructure that was created for the local government?
That's correct, because it's limited to half of the total loan amount.
Project cost.
And the project cost can be a subset of the total cost for the site. You don't have to borrow
right
against the whole cost. Yeah.
I was just trying to get the, reasoning for forgiving a loan. Most banks would go out of business if they forgave loans all the time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, there's a couple of different ways that you can approach this idea, and one is to not do a loan and to do a reimbursement. Sort of like, I don't want the sky to fall, but Gainshare is an example that you could take something like that model with more bookends on it, so it's not open-ended, and do a reimbursement as opposed to a loan. The downside of that is that there are a lot of jurisdictions around the state that just don't have their own capital resources, their own ability to borrow on the upfront end to get reimbursed later. So the loan opens the program to a lot more potential participants.
Representative Unger.
Since you opened up the
Gainshare
question. So how does it, because aren't we already doing this with Gainshare, and how does this project intersect with the money? I mean, my understanding of how Gainshare works is that the graphs that you showed us are really, you kind of cut them in half because the income tax revenue created from some of these property tax abatements, 50% of it goes back to the local jurisdiction, 50% of it stays with the state. Does this another slice out of the state's 50%, or how does that all fit together?
You'd have to answer
no,
that.
No, I'm not.
I can tell you.
I really appreciate you bringing this up. Trying to talk about it.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Unger, just in terms of the differences with Gainshare, the mechanism for calculating the revenue generated by a site, in talking with Paul Werner, he's confident that we could use the same mechanism to identify the revenue that would be generated from the site. So that process is well understood at this point. The bookends that I'm talking about, unlike Gainshare, it wouldn't be open-ended, so you're not taking a percentage of that revenue forever, no matter what it grows to. It's bounded by the loan amount. It's bounded by the fact that it can only be 50% of the revenue that's generated by that site, and then it's bounded, in the third case, by the total amount that the legislature determines that it's willing to allocate to that program in that biennium. The second part of your question, we would have to huddle and get back to you on that, the answer to that particular question.
And I can ask one quick follow-up. Is there a reason why, now that we have Gainshare, why local jurisdictions couldn't use their Gainshare proceeds to just do this program without our help?
Mr. Chair, Representative Unger, Gainshare is tied to the SIP, so not all of these sites would qualify for SIP. In fact, most of them wouldn't qualify. So this, it would narrow the application considerably.
Okay, thank you.
Is that the end of our presentation, too? Is that the last slide?
That's it.
So one thing that I might flag for you to consider supporting. You're talking about essentially the state becoming more of a financial partner, but another way for the state to contribute is to not make it so difficult in the first place, obviously. And so I am working with this governor, at least, to prepare something, but it won't be ready for a few years, but it's embodied in House Bill 2620. And essentially would call for a reorganization plan of state economic development and natural resource agencies to approach local economic development strategies more as a partner than it does a regulator. And, instead of, okay, did you get your DSL? Did you get your land? Blah, 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 blah. It would change their incentives to want to help versus just be assigned the role of regulator. And they may not get all their fees if it doesn't ever get to completion, so things like that. So anyway, the bill is like two lines and tells the governor to go back and prepare a plan for 2 years from now, but you should participate in the if the bill passes in the plan, because the goal is to make it less onerous for you when you've got a local vision from the state side. The governor likes to get bills telling him what to do. I'm sure it's got a high chance of passage. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've exhausted our questions, and apparently we're not going to finish at 4 o'clock like I predicted. So let me call up our little panel of folks here. Patrick Story, Sean Gillian, Alma Flores. I ate my string cheese. So, Patrick, I've got you on the list first.
Thank you. My name is Patrick Story. I represent Tax Fairness Oregon. And I want to say first that Tax Fairness Oregon understands the value of preparing market-ready industrial sites suitable to help bring traded sector development into the state and potentially enhance tax revenues in the future. However, as we read HB 2284, it seeks to have the Oregon Business Development Department establish an Oregon Industrial Site Readiness Program to make loans to private landowners, and this is the aspect of it that Representative Davis brought up a few moments ago, to make loans to private landowners for the market-ready development of their sites. These proposed loans are 50% forgivable if the owner contracts with an eligible employer within 5 years. An eligible employer is one who has hired even a single full-time employee who earns the county or state average income, whichever is less. The bill should set higher standards. More than one job and salary earnings that meet the higher of state or county average income would be more appropriate. Now, as we read the bill, the language of it is worth attending to, because it reveals a remarkable and, to many of us, a new attitude toward taxpayers' money. Subsection 1.4 stipulates that, quote, public assistance is necessary to overcome development-related constraints and to incentivize industrial site development in the state, unquote. Furthermore, subsection 1.5 continues that, quote, the state of Oregon is the primary beneficiary from increased income tax revenues, unquote, that might possibly be generated in the future by industrial site development. And these income tax revenues, quote, should be shared and invested in industrial site development. To us, this is a remarkable claim that public money must be shared with private investors. Surely, that's not a tenable claim. Tax revenue that is created with public help should go to public needs, schools, state police, healthcare, and the rest that makes an inviting business climate possible. So we believe that state loans to help private owners develop their land for industrial use, which is profitable use, should not be forgiven. Thank you.
Any questions? So you got to that last paragraph, I thought you were the Cascade Policy Institute for a moment. Then I looked, and John was out of the room, so couldn't, threw me off. Representative Julian. Sorry, because he's got a promotion.
I finally got the
what
promotion.
What district do you live in is the question. Who did I just oust?
Yeah, Representative Davis, actually.
Oh, sorry.
Chair.
Sorry about that.
It's always good to hear from a constituent.
Yes. thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Economic Development Association today. This is one of those few times where I wish I would have actually testified first to kind of put the committee a little bit at ease, because this is a proposal we've been working with Senator Beyer and Representative Reed on. It's certainly not ready for prime time. So as you guys kind of delved into the details of the bill, I think that was actually very productive for us.
We have a work session ready to go.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. I figured. And this bill's only referred to 14 committees after this, so it was on the glide path. But you know, I think
in recension memos line.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chair, that it was helpful to hear the concerns you all have. I think the underlying concepts of the bill, in that we don't have enough industrial land available, that a lot of local governments don't have the resources to do due diligence to figure out what sites are available in their area. I think you saw a very comprehensive study by the Port of Portland and PBA. Unfortunately, in other areas of the state, they don't have the resources to do that sort of study. So I think the idea of due diligence grants is very important to OEDA members, and we look forward to moving forward, working on something either in your committee, Mr. Chair, or over on the Senate side with the companion bills that's a little more palatable and answers a lot of the questions that you all had here today. You did ask one question about Senate Bill 766. Mm-hmm. What we had done before. A lot of you are familiar, but Senate Bill 766 basically provided for an expedited permitting process for lands that are industrial, that are either regionally significant or of state significance. The one criticism that I've heard since we enacted 766 is there aren't enough lands available for that process. And the exact analogy is, great, you guys put an express lane in a grocery store with no groceries. I have argued that there's a couple groceries on the shelf, but this process would hopefully be able to provide a few more mm-hmm. sites that are ready for that. Mm-hmm. My other hat, obviously you all know that I represent the realtors as well. What we hear from our commercial brokers is very true as far as...
Not signed up.
Exactly. And so, you know, the economic... And I figured, Mr. Chair, the only way I was going to get to talk in this committee right. this session is if I came up under a different client. So.
That is correct.
So, you know, I think the perception is reality out there as far as luring companies into the state that we don't have enough land. Putting these processes in place would help cure that perception a little bit. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions.
That's fantastic. Alma.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem and members of the committee. My name is Alma Flores, and I serve as the City of Beaverton's Economic Development Manager. My main role at the city is to ensure that existing and potentially new businesses have the land, labor, infrastructure, and capital or tools they need to locate and expand in Beaverton. For those of you who are not familiar with the city of Beaverton, Beaverton is a suburb west of Portland with a burgeoning population of over 91,000 coming from varying economic and social backgrounds. We are blessed with a strategic and competitive location within the region as part of what has been coined the Silicon Forest. We benefit from highly educated workforce, an established and mature infrastructure, a strong and growing set of small and medium-sized businesses, and new economic development tools such as the Enterprise Zone. We believe that House Bill 2284 and 2285 are important new tools to make Oregon competitive regionally, nationally, and globally. However, in their current form, the tools these bills offer are out of our reach. In short, what the city lacks is a good supply of shovel-ready large lots, as defined in House Bill 2284 and House Bill 2285. We, however, feel that it is important for the state to expand and provide tools and resources to communities that face different challenges and have a different set of constraints. I want to briefly state what our current land constraints are in Beaverton. Currently, we have only 44 industrially zoned vacant parcels and only 46 redevelopable industrially zoned parcels, a total of just over 90 parcels. And of those 90 industrially zoned parcels, 46 are contaminated, making the due diligence tool as valuable as the loan. Of those vacant and redevelopable industrial parcels, 71 are over 5 acres, just one is larger than 10 acres, and none are 25 acres or larger. The city of Beaverton is eager to bring more industrial development to Oregon, but we need access to the right tools to do it. Mature urban communities like Beaverton have already invested in infrastructure and have close access to the port, highly educated workers, and freight access. We respectfully request that the threshold under House Bill 2284 and 2285 be lowered to 5 acres to reflect more mature urban areas with existing infrastructure and direct access to a growing and highly skilled workforce. Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sean, I'll note the 1,000 Friends of Oregon submitted a letter in support of these bills. See,
you guys are turning over a new leaf.
As usual. speaking of which, he probably doesn't want me to talk about that. Dan Eisenbeis from the City of Portland, you want to come up, and Greg Leo. And this other nice gentleman.
For the record, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, Greg Leo representing the City of Wilsonville. City of Wilsonville has long had industrial land that we've been unable to develop, primarily because of the cost reasons outlined in this bill. This bill is a good approach. It's part of a collaborative effort. It sets us on the right path, I think, for developing the land that should be developed in our area. So we would support the bill here today. Our only concerns are that the bill applies within the urban growth boundary, and it does. So we support the bill and hope you'll pass it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Klim, members of the committee, Dan Eisenbeis with the City of Portland. With me here today is Steve Kuntz, Senior Economic Planner for the City of Portland. We believe that both of these bills are promising concepts, and I want to say that we very much appreciate the work of the stakeholders who conducted the study in the Portland metro region, as well as the work of Representative Reed and Senator Beyer. Also want to acknowledge Representative Frederick's work to promote redevelopment of brownfields throughout the state. There's clearly some nexus between that work and these proposals. Steve will talk more specifically about House Bill 2284, but we generally are supportive and very much would like to be part of the conversation moving forward.
Thank you, Dan. Mr. Chair and representatives. Again, I'm Steve Kuntz, City of Portland Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. I'm here to speak in favor of the two industrial land bills. We recognize the important concept of emphasizing traded sector development as our key driver of regional and state prosperity, bringing export income and jobs into the state, and raising wage levels. We agree with the concepts presented that short supplies of developable industrial land have been a significant barrier to traded sector growth because those businesses have other options, location options to locate. This legislation appears to be an innovative approach to addressing this need, and we support the concept or something like it to address these issues. It's particularly significant in the city of Portland. It's a large industrial center in the metro area. There are about 14,000 acres of industrial land. The substantial annexations that we had in the 1980s and 90s have primarily built out, and therefore the land that's available for industrial development and growth is primarily more constrained, vacant sites such as brownfield sites with other types of constraints. So resources like this are important. The City of Portland recently completed an economic opportunities analysis comparing 25-acre demand with existing land supply. In the industrial areas, we've essentially found demand for about 30,000 additional jobs. We have about 100,000 jobs in our industrial areas. But the available market-ready supply to meet those jobs over the next 25 years is only about 60%, so we have about a 600-acre shortfall. So resources like this would be a significant opportunity to develop more brownfields and more constrained sites and meet that demand. That said, we would like to suggest, as the City of Beaverton, a potential improvement in HB 2284 to also reduce the site size from 25-acre threshold to potentially 10 acres. We've suggested, in order to be more responsive to predominant industrial land demand. In the City of Portland's industrial districts, in the 12-year period between 1999 and 2011, an estimated 91% of the substantial industrial development that occurred, measured by square footage, was in sites smaller than 20 acres. 91% smaller than 20 acres. It's our bread and butter industrial land demand. We don't hit that many home runs, a lot of singles and doubles, and that's what generates most of the job growth in the industrial areas in Portland, the Portland market. And also, this is particularly important for brownfield redevelopment. We have substantial, over 500 acres of industrial area brownfields in the city. Most of them are, we have four or five larger sites that fit into that 25-acre category of vacant brownfields, but most of our brownfields are small and medium-sized sites, and so this would be a much more significant tool to improve our rate of brownfield redevelopment if the site size was reduced. While we understand the 25-acre threshold for emphasizing recruitment of large employers, that makes sense, and it's a strategic focus on large sites, that makes sense as well, but it could be a lot more useful to address more industrial land demand, particularly in the Portland market, with a smaller site size threshold. Thank you for your consideration. And we can answer any questions.
Question for these gentlemen. Representative Holdy.
No, thanks. You made mention that this bill applies to only lands inside the urban growth boundary, and I was seeking that information in the bill, and I guess it's 25 acres or greater in a metropolitan statistical area as defined in ORS 267010, I think. Is that the reference you're making?
Yes, I believe that's true, Mr. Chair.
Which is under a mass transit district statute.
What we're concerned about, of course, is superseding industrial on UGB. And, of course, Wilsonville, because of our location, you know, there in the Willamette Valley, we're very concerned that it be in lands that have already been planned to be developed. And we've asked those questions of the coalition. We're satisfied that the answer is that this will be inside urban growth boundaries in lands that have been planned to be developed.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up. So does that mean that to be eligible, this land would have to be annexed to the city before it got developed?
No, I understand. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey. No, it would not need to be annexed. And we have a good example of that with Coffee Creek. where, you know, the state of Oregon put, you know, the state prison there with the idea that the area around the prison would be developed industrially. There it sat now for almost 10 years.
Don't say the words Day Road ever again in this building.
Yes,
there's
I know.
A 20-year moratorium on those words.
But there it sits largely because of the problems of parcel aggregation and the incredible expense of putting pipe in the ground and literally bringing those urban services to that area. This is a creative and important approach to dealing with land that we've already decided to urbanize, but yet don't have the resources to use. So it's a good step in the right direction. We support the bill, and we hope you'll consider it.
He likes to bring up annexation to bother me. Well, don't worry. We'll have plenty of hearings on next week.
Thank
Anybody
you.
Else? Okay, thank you.
Great.
And that's the end of my sign-up sheet. Is anybody else here on these bills? Only half an hour past my estimates. Great. Then I will close the public hearings on House Bills 2284 and 2285. Anything else for the good of the order? With that, the committee is adjourned.